Welcome to our discussion segment on The Civil War, Part 2. I'm Joe Parker.
And I'm John Streeter.
Let's get started.
Part two of a difficult topic.
Yeah.
Although I think this one may be a little less controversial.
In part one, I really wanted to address the lead up to the war.
Yeah.
And just moreover, how it affected our history overall. I'll say this, and I like how you said it in the podcast. Please forgive me. It's going to be impossible to ask every question I want to in the time allotted. So I will do my very best.
Yeah. I have friends in college who study the Civil War history now professionally, and I'm sure if they heard this, they'd be like, but you didn't talk about this, and you didn't talk about that. Yeah,
that
sorry.
Is accurate.
I'm sorry.
We did our best. Yeah, we're trying our best.
15-minute history, not 10,000-minute history.
Yeah, great quote. I tried to divide up kind of our topics today with cultural battle tactics and Abraham Lincoln overall, just trying to go through that. From a cultural standpoint, aside from the direct effects of the Civil War, so end of slavery and so on, what do you teach about the long-term effects of the Civil War?
The main one is obviously the ending of slavery, the process of Reconstruction, which ultimately sets the stage for the long battle for civil rights, because Reconstruction was a failure. The South was not fully, it was purged of slavery, certainly, but the North did not purge the South of a desire to continue to oppress African Americans. So when we finish the Civil War, the very next chapter deals with Reconstruction and segregation, and that is the longest running cultural impact of the Civil War, the longest running cultural effect of the Civil War, because it then takes another century for the country to deal with segregation and get to legal equality between white and black Americans. And then once we do that, because there is still racial tension in this country, we then switch over from the legal side, which is the bulk of American history, is legal oppression. And now we talk about social oppression and how important it is for all of us as individuals to kind of purge our own hearts of feelings of resentment and racism. Not saying that all of us have racist sentiments, but those that do, and if we find it in our society, we need to address it, but not always through the law. A legal response to social discrimination is not always a good idea. And again, we've covered that in earlier episodes. I don't want to necessarily get too deep into that. But to answer your question, Reconstruction is the biggest event that we cover post-Civil War that came out of it that then sets the stage for longer cultural movements.
How would you summarize Reconstruction? And obviously,
You can't. Okay.
Obviously, it could have been done better. But I'm just saying, like, my reason for asking is because you talked about the idea that you can't force a change of heart.
Well, you can, but it takes a long time.
Right. Was there a better way to reconstruct the South, knowing that these were people who owned other human beings? To suddenly have an expectation that they're wrong, that idea is wrong, that suddenly they would be like, oh, well, I'm going to see them as equals.
Yeah.
How should it have gone? I don't want to say should it have gone.
Right.
But
the only example from, and it's subsequent American history. And so, you want to avoid kind of retrospectively criticizing with better information at the time. At the time, I don't think it was a better option open to the North because they didn't have the political will to occupy the South for generations. Now, in World War II, as I mentioned in the podcast, we were able to, quote, reconstruct Nazi Germany, but a lot of that was because of new technology and the media. A lot of Germans didn't know what was going on in the camps, just like a lot of Southerners didn't know what was going on the plantations. But with World War II, you have video, you have audio, you have interviews. We have photos, and we blanketed the parts of Germany that the United States and Great Britain and France occupied after World War II with those images to say, this is what you allowed to happen. And it is what ultimately changed German culture. Not overnight, took years, really took decades. There are still some people today who say, oh, the Holocaust didn't happen. And, you know, Hitler, he went too far, but there he had some decent ideas. Again, that's not me saying it, just so we're clear. John is not saying this, but you didn't have that ability in 1865. You had photography. But the mindset of most Southerners was not going to be changed unless they actually witnessed it, saw it with their eyes. And so then the only option is raise their children and have Northerners in the schools and Southern abolitionists in the schools. And that's generations of military occupation, generations of building a new culture in the South. And by 1876, you know, you're 11 years into this, the North is just done. The United States does not have the patience for long-term nation building, which is what that is.
So, John, it sounds like Reconstruction ensured continued suppression of people.
It didn't have to, but it resulted, not ensured, it resulted in continued suppression in the South.
If it had been handled differently, and again, I don't know what differently
the what
is.
If, the what if yeah, questions. Yeah, yeah.
Is there a chance that there wouldn't have been Jim Crow laws or any of the other things?
Yeah, there's a chance.
Okay.
Or that it would have been dealt with more severely. The North would have said, Congress would have said, nope, you're not doing that.
Okay.
But because of the 1876 fiasco with the election, the South now had a bargaining chip. We will cast our electors and basically give us a president, and in exchange, you let us do our own thing, you end Reconstruction, or we can continue to languish under military occupation, and you can have the first constitutional crisis in which there is no president, and we'll see what happens then. And there's the possibility of another civil war.
Hmm. Okay. So understanding that, was there anything else that could have been done to push back against racism at the time and accelerate the process of everyone truly being equal?
I mean, I already mentioned education, but again, I don't know that there was a political will for that. They did the best they could. I mean, the KKK was suppressed pretty quickly and pretty effectively by President Grant. I think there could have been more of an issue made of the KKK. And I will confess, my knowledge of Reconstruction history is much less complete than Civil War. But my understanding is there was not an overall, like, not propaganda, but public awareness campaign about the crimes committed by the KKK. And I think there could have been more of that across the South to say, listen, again, this is the kind of stuff that your beliefs are creating. You need to re-examine, you know, what it is that you truly believe about the nature of equality and the definition of personhood. Hmm. And there wasn't that. Again, I'm not faulting, and it may have happened, but I'm not, if it didn't, I'm not faulting that. I fault the people who committed those crimes, the racist dirtbags in the KKK of all generations, including the racist dirtbags in the KKK right now,
right,
for their crimes.
In terms of the battles that you talked about, why did everything culminate at Gettysburg?
That was an accident. It was not intended for there to be a giant battle at Gettysburg. It was what today we would call mission creep. Basically, we start with a limited, specific objective. In this case, a division under, I believe it was Harry Heath, went to Gettysburg during this massive campaign in which all the various divisions of Lee's army are in different places, marching separately so they couldn't be attacked and destroyed in a concentrated battle. Harry Heath finds out that there are some shoes in a warehouse in Gettysburg. And he said, you know, my men have been marching for months. A lot of them don't have shoes anymore, so we're going to go get them. That's Union property. We're going to appropriate it. And there was a Union cavalry brigade in Gettysburg that formed up and stopped them and engaged them in combat. Lines were formed. And then from there, Heath sends a message to Lee, and Lee says, okay, yeah, we'll send in a couple of reinforcements, and then more, and then more, and then more. And General Buford, the Union commander, sends out word to his superior, George Meade, I need more troops, and the battle just built and built and built and built until we get the Great Clash on July 3rd with Pickett's charge.
Was there a point over the course of 4 days that both sides realized that this would be a turning point?
No.
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 Okay.
It's very rare when battles are going on for people to be like, this might be a turning point. Usually it's historians who make that point.
Okay. So when you were talking about Little Round Top, that's an awesome story.
Yeah.
When you said that he said fix bayonets, and that was something that was so rare.
Why would you charge across a field 300 yards right towards someone who could very easily hit you? It'd be like charging someone today with a single-shot bolt-action rifle.
So that's why they were shocked.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Bayonets were not used anymore. Bayonets were there basically as a holdover from earlier times. They were used on very rare occasions, like in forest warfare. And that's what this was, and that's why it worked, because if you've been to Little Round Top, you go to Gettysburg, it's covered with trees. That's the only reason why, that and just sheer exhaustion on the part of these Confederate soldiers who are marching
uphill
again and again and again.
When they charged forward, was there a better understanding of the Southerners, like how many there were, how
they knew well they were outnumbered, but I don't know that they knew exactly how badly they were outnumbered.
So the Confederacy sees the Union charge coming down.
They don't see it, they hear it first.
Okay.
And these are big guys, and they were ordered to make as much noise as they could. So it probably sounded like 400, 500, 600 people are coming at them.
Okay.
But in fact, it was like 80 something.
Gotcha. So yeah. Perceptively, the Confederates
smoke.
Thought that
yeah, there's smoke and there are small brush fires going on. No, they can't see anything. And then they start to see, you know, 4 or 5 guys come out of the smoke with bayonets aimed right at them. Some of them hadn't loaded their weapons, and so they dropped their weapons and ran, or they fired, and you get basically it built on each other because, if these guys, they're just the fastest. There's more coming. And so the panic started to spread in the ranks of the Confederacy, and they ultimately fell back.
Did that practice become more widely used?
No.
After this?
No.
Okay.
Well, okay, as I say that, I mean, World War One, there were plenty of infantry charges. So
it's interesting to think about why it was effective, though. Because to your point, the Union soldiers were outnumbered.
Yeah.
And yet they were still able to take the day.
Okay, so the specifics of forest warfare and an outnumbered enemy, I can't think of another major battle where that, I mean, Belleau Wood at the tail end of World War One, I think Americans were outnumbered and they did charge through a forest at one point, but it was not widely used, no.
Okay.
There are still infantry charges, but a bayonet charge through the woods.
No. Yeah, just out of curiosity, how far did those men charge? Like, how far did
it's
they
about,
run?
Oh, gosh. I haven't been to Gettysburg in a long time.
But as the Southerners started to pull back and retreat, how far did they chase them?
Oh, they just went to the base of the hill. They did not. I think it was maybe 300-400 yards.
Okay.
I don't think they went much farther than that. Now, some of them were like, yeah, we're going to keep them going. We're going to send them all the way back to Richmond.
It's like, everybody stop. Stop there.
It's been a long day. Most of us have bullet wounds in our bodies. Yeah,
almost all of us are dying. Let's just,
yeah, let's take a breather here, guys.
Let's talk about another charge, Pickett's charge. Coming at it from my perspective, obviously it's easy. I'm sitting in a room reading about this. And when I look across a field, if I were to see a line of men holding firearms up, pointing at me, it would not be my first inclination to run towards that.
Right.
It would be
you
to
would
find
cover. You would not be a good soldier
right.
in 1865 or 63.
Apparently not. Yeah. I'm happy to say that. But with that in mind, when the Union soldiers stood up and they started firing, have you read anything or studied anything that Pickett was like, huh, this is no longer a viable tactic. We need to pull back.
And Pickett, to be clear, Pickett was not with his men.
Okay.
Pickett, like divisional commanders did. So you had Lee and Longstreet at the southern base of Seminary Ridge, where the Pickett's charge troops, where they started. Pickett accompanied his men about halfway there. And then he had runners with him so he could give directions, but he needed to be able to see the whole battlefield. It wasn't cowardice. Pickett was not, I mean, he was an interesting character. He was not a coward. He wanted to go in with his men, but his job as a divisional commander was to command the entire division. So he had three brigades that he needed to keep track of. So he's only about halfway across the field. And then it's the brigade and the regimental commanders who go the rest of the way and who go in with the troops. So Pickett did recognize this is not, I think it was about 20 minutes into the actual fighting.
How many men had died already in 20 minutes?
Most of them. It was a very, very short, very, very short battle. But a lot of it was because he couldn't see. Because the Union cannons had opened fire. Both sides are exchanging
fire. So smoke
fire.
Everywhere, all over the battlefield.
Oh, yeah. No one really understands, even if you've gone to a Civil War reenactment, just how smoky a Civil War battlefield was. You could not see your own face after, like, your third shot from your musket or your rifle, even regardless of what other people are doing. Your vision is obscured so badly, there's no real way to see much in the distance.
Hmm.
One of the greatest inventions in military history was smokeless gunpowder.
Yeah.
Something that people don't generally talk about. So Pickett got the blame because the charge was named for him. It was not his fault. I'm not a huge Pickett fan, certainly because he was fighting for the South. I think he's an amusing character because he was like this brash young guy who thought he could do whatever he wanted, who thought that his men were invincible, that the cause was going to lead them to victory. And he also scored dead last in his class at West Point. I mean, dead last. And yet, until Pickett's charge, he had never lost a battle. Hmm. Showing that he was a very, very good, very competent leader. He also loved to wear perfume, not cologne, actual perfume, because he thought it smelled better. And so he would have it shipped to him while the army was out on campaign from stores in Richmond, which I thought was kind of interesting.
That's an interesting...
Not making any kind of claims about his personal life or anything
like
that.
Yeah, that's an interesting note.
He wanted to smell nice. And when you think about the stench and the filth of Civil War camps, I would probably be willing to put a little bit of perfume on. I know, sounded really weird. As I'm saying, I'm like, no, don't say that.
I'm just going to let you talk. How did he signal for them to retreat? Like, what was
he didn't. It was just, okay, yep.
It was a rout.
It's over. No, it was not a rout. It was an orderly retreat, but it was the regimental and commanders who did it.
Okay.
It was the colonels and the majors who did it because all three of the brigade commanders, the only generals who were actually up there on the field, all three of them died.
So after this battle, is it later on that the generals understand the importance of it? Or does it take years later?
No, I mean, by the time Lincoln gives the Gettysburg Address in, I believe it was November of that same year, it's very clear, not that this is going to be the turning point of the war, because you can't wars usually have multiple turning points where it slowly starts to turn. We don't realize that Gettysburg together with Vicksburg were the turning points of the war until the war is over. But it's certainly a significant battle, and people realize that. Vicksburg was actually the more decisive at the time because, again, it cuts the Confederacy in half. Now the food supplies are starting to run low.
So shifting a little bit in terms of battle tactics, I wanted to talk about Sherman.
All of you should go back and listen to our episode in season 2 about General Sherman.
Yes.
It's a full biography. But yes, his war experience. Let's talk about that a bit.
I love General Sherman. Mm-hmm. I think he's just awesome.
Yeah.
Was there anyone like him before in U.S. history in terms of a commanding general? Had the likes of him ever been seen before?
In terms of which aspects?
In terms of his tactical approach to total war.
Well, no one had considered total war before. The Civil War is the first war in which civilians were even considered to be.
So he was the first one targets. In...
It wasn't him.
Okay.
Grant was the one who gave him the order. Sherman was carrying out Grant's instructions.
Okay.
Grant was the strategic visionary who realized, hey, we can win this war, not just on the battlefield, but by starving the Confederates to death.
Okay.
But in terms of his ability to command troops on the field, he's very, very similar to Nathaniel Greene, who was one of Washington's best generals. In the closing years of the Revolutionary War.
And I was asking from the perspective of like when he would make statements like, I'm going to make Georgia howl. Like,
okay, well, that's his personality.
Yeah.
That's not his abilities to command or anything like that. In terms of his personality...
Because that has very strong notes of total war to me.
Oh, yeah.
Like regardless of Grant, like what...
But that was... I get what you're saying. That was part of his orders, though. So in terms of him, like his rhetorical flourishes... I mean, Benedict Arnold, he had some pretty quippy lines before his betrayal.
If that wasn't what made him different, what in your mind made him a different kind of commander?
I think it was certainly his passionate belief in abolition. I mean, he was the most pro-abolition and the most ardent opponent of slavery in the U.S. military, certainly at the command level. And it was also his abilities to outflank and outmaneuver the enemy, unlike Grant, who was just a battering ram. Now, he had to be because he had to get through Lee's army to get to Richmond. Sherman rarely engaged Joseph Johnson or John Bell Hood or any of the other Confederate generals sent to stop him because he didn't need to. He had huge, wide open spaces to maneuver, whereas in Virginia, you've got the coast and the Chesapeake Bay and you have the Appalachian Mountains. Not a whole lot of room to move. Sherman had everything from the Appalachians to the Mississippi if he needed it. So he, like George Washington before him, engaged in a war of maneuver. That was a large part of his tactical brilliance. I think his meme-worthiness of his quotes are important because they reflect his hatred of the South, of secession, and of slavery. But it's more about his ability, one, on the battlefield, and two, to execute the March to the Sea with such brilliance and with such restraint. Most generals, with an army the size of his, he had like 65,000 men at his command, and no opposition, he would have just unleashed his men on the people who lived in the areas that he was destroying. To my knowledge, yes, some people were attacked, some people lost their property, they were assaulted, especially some women, and those are horrible. I'm not, again, defending, I keep having to make that claim, but I just want to be very, very clear because of the culture we live in. Those were not supported or authorized or anything by General Sherman, and he punished every instance of assault, of theft, of murder that he found in his own men.
Mm-hmm. In reading the book, The Soul of Battle by Victor Davis Hanson, there's a whole part of the book on Sherman.
Mm-hmm.
A quick quote here that I love because there was a sense of Southern culture that I think shielded or gave people the perception that it was something it wasn't. Quote, "The army of Sherman was now exposing one of the great embarrassments of the chivalric apartheid society. Rhetoric, costumes, polite manners, titles, and arcane traditions among a privileged elite hide weakness rather than reflect strength." I mean, first of
only,
all...
Only Victor Davis Hanson could write a sentence like that.
Fantastic burn. But, I mean, it is interesting that as he marched to the sea and he was able to feed his armies, in the process of doing that, he was able to expose the other side of what people perceive to be Southern culture and all that. So my question...
Well, okay, so I always thought that was not about food, that was about breaking their sense of martial pride.
Well, I think that him supplying his armies and moving the way that he was actually accomplishing that.
Oh, okay.
So as he marched south, he was breaking... their will. So my question is, was that one of the breaking points? Like, was his ability to change the perception of the South one of the ways that the South reconsidered itself to the point where we don't have anything left?
It was a breaking point in fact, but not a breaking point in spirit. The South only got angrier, and it hardened their resolve to continue to fight. Now, not locally in Georgia, but as people in other parts of the country that were still fighting heard what was going on in Georgia, they're like, okay, we're going to make you pay for that. But the reality by the end of 1864 and into 1865 was the South could no longer feed itself. And so as Lee's army starts to dwindle, as he's gearing up for his 1865 campaign, in which he thinks, you know, there might still be a chance, like Bernie supporters, he is.
And, you just had to add that,
and Trump supporters too.
Yeah,
anyway,
yep.
He could still be president by the summer.
Sorry. Yeah, everyone, just stop that. Please
stop
that.
That's my only political comment. I'm throwing my political hat around across the room.
If you're thinking that, please stop that now. Thank you.
As Lee is preparing for this last great campaign, the food supplies are drying up, and he's wondering, oh boy, I'm not able to feed as many of my soldiers. And that was Sherman's march to the sea and what it did. So it did not break their spirit and their desire to fight, but it broke their ability to feed themselves.
One of the things that Hansen talks about in his book is how one of the men who was freed described Sherman's army as the North had emptied.
Yes.
It was so vast. Describe his battle, like how he arranged his troops, how far apart were they?
It was three sections spread, I think it was over a total of like 50 or 60 miles. And that was... It's interesting that I had forgotten. I read Soul of Battle years ago. I remember reading that quote, but his army was actually relatively small compared to Grant's and certainly compared to later armies. He had about 65, I think, or 70,000 soldiers. But from the perspective of a freed slave, I'm sure he thought that the North had emptied because he's seeing thousands of white faces.
Was his battle formations specifically just to protect his flanks, or was it also to create the effect of we are a force not to be trifled with?
No, it was about casting as wide a net of destruction as possible.
Okay.
You spread your troops out and you march at roughly the same pace so you can cut a larger swath out of the Confederacy's breadbasket.
Okay. Sherman hated slavery before the war.
Yes.
How did that change the farther south he went?
He just hated it more and more with every plantation that was liberated.
In his writings, is there ever a place where he said, I need to restrain myself because I'm going to obliterate everything?
I don't think so.
No?
No. He was a pretty restrained guy.
Okay.
Yeah.
I would have written that in my journals. Did his increased...
Now that I think about it, he expressed some sympathy for the people whose lives he was destroying. Because I think you said that you would write that. I don't know that you would. I think after seeing the 400th house that you've burned as women and children watch their lives go up in smoke, I think you would start to feel maybe a little bit of sympathy towards them. With especially the recognition that not all of these people own slaves.
Right.
Not all of these people necessarily even supported slavery. So again... One more time, not defending the slave owners, not defending the Southern ideals.
Well, the people you're talking about aren't slave owners, right?
I mean, some of them were. He destroyed some pretty beautiful plantations.
No, I'm just saying, like, the example you use were not all of them were slave owners.
Right. I think he was just like, just quit. And as soon as the South did, Sherman was one of the most passionate voices for a just peace. Not a kind peace, but a peace that was not, like, triumphant, where it's like, yeah, we beat you, and now we're going to keep on taking. It was not what the radical Republicans ultimately did after Lincoln died.
So
Sherman wanted to make peace with the South.
Does that stand in contrast to how he waged war and his philosophy on war to make it as bad as possible?
I think it's perfectly consistent. When he said war is cruelty and there's no use reforming it, the crueler it is, the sooner it will end. The sooner it will end is so we can have a just peace. Now, you lost, and so you're going to have to conform to what we say. He did not believe that, okay, you know, the war is over, now you can do what you want. But he did understand, or he did want to make peace as quickly as possible. But he's not going to do it without beating his enemy. Because he understood that if you don't beat your enemy, and this was the lesson of the Mexican War, or of the Texas Revolution, they're going to come back. And it's also the lesson throughout history. And you're going to get another war.
How do you define beat them?
On the battlefield. You break their spirit. You get...
It's not a defeat of their forces.
No, it is a defeat of their force. You break their army's ability and their will to fight.
But when earlier you were talking about the will of the South, like we just fight on. We have spirit. What was it his internally? Was it his goal to break that spirit?
No. You break the army and its ability and its spirit, and you force it to surrender. Victory is achieved when the enemy lays down, all of them, their arms. That's why Sherman continued to fight even after Lee surrendered. Mm. Sherman fights for another two weeks. Because I've still got an enemy in front of me, and I'm going to break his spirit as well and his ability to fight.
Yeah,
it's not about the people.
I think that there's a distinction between defeating an army on the battlefield and breaking their spirit. And so you're saying that's
a semantic difference. If it simplifies for our audience, Sherman's goal was to defeat the South's armies. Once that was accomplished, either through starvation, killing them, or breaking their spirit, he was done. And okay. He was ready for peace.
Okay.
Yeah.
So General Grant.
Mm. He was a bit squeamish.
He was. Was that one of the reasons why they wanted him removed?
Love this story. No, he was. Wait.
Like
what?
So you were saying in the podcast that there was pressure to remove Grant.
Yeah. It's nothing to do with him being squeamish. That was a separate thing.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
So
he didn't like blood.
He did not.
No, he would become physically ill at the sight of a rare steak.
How did he
exactly
do his job?
I have no idea how he did his job.
Oh, man.
He was also he was painfully shy. He would not shower in the presence of his men. I have no idea how he did his job.
That's pretty surprising.
Any blood, he would become physically ill.
He was in the wrong line of work.
Well, yeah. He only visited a battlefield during the whole march towards Petersburg. He only visited the battlefield one time. Not because he was indifferent, but because he didn't want to
pass out in front of his men.
But anyway, pressure to relieve him.
So in the you were talking about how there were requests to have him.
Oh yeah.
Was there a disconnect between what the North thought was going on in the battle or in the war than what was actually happening, or was that a reasonable request at the time because of the loss of life?
The loss of life was pretty excessive.
But it was excessive on both sides.
Especially at Cold Harbor.
Okay. And to quote you, not excusing the loss of life.
Right.
But
I mean, like at Cold Harbor, he hurled 60,000 men in a Pickett's Charge style attack against trenches. Because he thought, all right, the South, you know, I've ground them down pretty badly. I think I can break through their lines. Nope. 8,000 Union soldiers died in 8 minutes. Without a single machine gun or anything like that, any modern weaponry.
Hmm.
That's where Grant visited the battlefield afterwards, because he realized, okay, I have to see what I have done. So the casualty figures were high, but again, given Grant's task, earlier campaigns in the first 3 years were focused on Richmond, on getting around the enemy, getting around General Lee, and getting to Richmond. Grant said, enough of that. It's like a game of chess. When you play chess, your goal ultimately, of course, is to kill the king, because that's how you win. The king is the city of Richmond, but that's not the most powerful piece in the game. I don't know how much you play chess, but do you know what the most powerful piece in the game is?
Yeah, the queen.
It's the queen. The queen is Lee's army. Everything that Grant did was aimed at Lee's army. He became the target. Lee didn't understand this, so he kept putting himself between Grant and Richmond, which is exactly what he wanted, and Grant would just go right at him. Like I said earlier, he's a battering ram. And so that's why the casualty figures were so high, because he's not like performing complex flanking moves to try and...
He just charges.
No, it's right at the enemy again and again and again and again.
I want to spend a little bit of time talking about Abraham Lincoln, obviously. Mm-hmm. We talked a little bit about things a lot this past week, but getting more into his work and the long-term effects, you rightly said last week that you can read some books where he is like a champion. He's mm-hmm. like the greatest thing that has ever happened. And then others where he is not. He's the exact opposite.
Or he's a dictator.
Right, right. So we see these opposite ends of the spectrum. And you said last week, rightly so, that you need to look at his actions.
Mm-hmm.
So based on his actions, are we able to determine, was he a champion of freedom or not?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
My opinion, there is only one event. Sorry, there are many. But the crowning achievement of Lincoln's quest for the new birth of freedom is not the 13th Amendment, it's not the Emancipation Proclamation. If Lincoln had truly been a dictator that so many people, especially at the time, but even today, a lot of revisionist Southern historians claim, in 1864, he could have just said, we're not having an election. But he did. He held an election in the middle of a war that was threatening to tear the country apart and made it very clear that if George McClellan, the Democratic nominee who would have allowed the country to dissolve, if he won, Lincoln would have stepped aside and said, all right, you are fairly in and I'm fairly out. Right there is all the evidence. And maybe I'm making the same mistake of picking out one instance, but it's one instance among many. Yes, Lincoln had to do bad things for good ends. The ends don't justify the means, but a lot of times the ends necessitate the means. And Lincoln had to do some very, very shady, unconstitutional things. I mean, the movie Lincoln provides a couple of examples. Right. We've talked about Lincoln before. Like, he's bribing members of Congress to pass the 13th Amendment. But it was all in pursuit of what he called the new birth of freedom. And the fact that he held that election in 1864 is pretty spectacular. I can think of several presidents who would have been like, ooh, I have an opportunity to not have to run for re-election. And who would have canceled or postponed.
And they would
15 days. We just need to postpone it for 15 days. 15 days to slow the spread of secessionism.
Accurate. It would have been interesting. It's like for the good of society, for our community as a whole, we need to put this on
hold. Oh, here we go.
Well, unfortunately, we've heard it all before.
Yeah.
So it's...
Yeah.
You quoted the speech where he says, with malice toward none.
The speech. You mean the greatest second inaugural address?
Absolutely.
In American history?
Yeah. Well, I agree with you. Yeah. It absolutely is.
The speech.
So if he had lived...
Oh, boy.
Again, what ifs? I get it. But
I hate these because I can't give you a good answer.
I know. But it's just, it seems like... it seems like he was just... spouting into the wind because didn't happen.
No, he was.
Didn't happen.
Whoa. What do you mean he was spouting into the wind?
Well, it seems like he was saying, this is what we need to strive for. This is what we need to do. Yeah. And then no one did it. I mean,
they did it while he was alive.
Well, I'm saying if he had lived, if he hadn't been killed, do you think that the South and everything that followed after the war would have been handled in a better way?
I can't say it would have been better. It would have been different. But you have pointed out several times as we've talked politics, in recent months, no one can predict what's going on. And I want
to throw,
throw that at you every time alongside my right shoe. Every time you ask me a what if question, no one can predict what's going to happen.
Obviously, he was right in saying
said. And you can look at what his military governors did in the areas that were already reconstructed. Tennessee and Mississippi, I believe, and most of Louisiana were already fully reconstructed before the Civil War ended. And those areas initially saw a greater sense of community and tolerance and less racial violence than areas that were not reconstructed. Now, they eventually went full segregationist, but that was after Reconstruction. So you're right. I can't give you a good answer. And one of these days you're going to learn that and stop asking me these what if questions. But
it's just fun to see you squirm a bit the what if.
Yeah, I'm sure. But you can look to what Lincoln did and you can speculate, and that's all I can do, that kind of program probably would have happened.
Okay.
Because Lincoln was such a powerful commanding figure, he was able to keep the radical Republicans in line. With his death, course,
they had free reign.
They had free reign, and they were ticked off. And so we got the harsh piece of Reconstruction and the unfinished piece of Reconstruction.
So obviously talking about the Civil War requires more time.
We've been talking about the Civil War? Sorry.
Just all these jokes flying at me. I don't know how to respond to them. So obviously, as we've been talking about the Civil War these past 2 weeks, you've made it clear, and I have as well, it is impossible for us to cover everything within the time frames that we currently have set up. What are some other ways our audience can learn about this time period that, again, don't paint extreme examples of one character and so on?
I would recommend it. 2 books, both by James McPherson. He is a pro-Northern historian, but he's pretty fair. The first covers the run-up to the Civil War, and it's called Ordeal by Fire. And the second is a classic of Civil War literature, The Battle Cry of Freedom. I would recommend both of those are big, but you can find them as ebooks or on Audible and things like that. Those are some really, really good sources. Beyond that, you want to look at Grant's autobiography. It is a triumph of self-awareness because Grant was very, very well of his own successes and his own failures, his triumphs, his flaws. And then, let's see, if you prefer kind of a blending of fiction and nonfiction, there are 3 books. The first is by Michael Shara. It's called The Killer Angels. And then his son took up the mantle and wrote 2 other books, Gods and Generals and Last Full Measure. I would recommend those. I think he's actually working on, they cover mainly the Eastern theater. He's also working on some Western theater books as well. There have been more books written about the Civil War than any other event, I believe, in world history, certainly in American history. So there's a lot out there.
That's understandable.
You can find stuff that's really, really good, stuff that's really, really bad. Basically, it's find the extremes. There's the Lincoln as, you know, second only to God himself, and then there's Lincoln as basically Hitler, only taller.
What do you say to people now who talk pretty openly about Civil War and just...
Yeah.
They just flippantly throw it out well, there's going to be a Civil War.
There's going to be a Civil War. Oh, we're going to rise up. We're going to, like the people at the Capitol on January 6th, like that.
Some of them.
Yeah. No, not everyone. I say to them this: you don't know what you are asking for. The American Civil War was the bloodiest war in our history. And it's easy to say that and just, it's the bloodiest. No. Each life is important. Each life is valuable to friends, to family, to loved ones, and, depending on your beliefs, to God. A civil war in the United States today, a country that is larger, that is more densely populated, and that has much better weaponry and technology, would be a bloodbath beyond imagination. We have political problems in this country. We have political divisions. We've talked about some. We're not going to talk about others in this podcast because, again, we want to try and, you know, keep this stuff pretty lighthearted. But we are nowhere near at the point where this country was in 1860. We have differences, but there is far more that unites us as Americans than that divides us. What you see on Twitter, what you see on cable news, what you see on the internet is not America. Real America is the relationships that we have, the friendships that we make each and every day. Right, left, Republican, Democrat, Trump, Biden, it doesn't matter. When I see friends of mine send in group chats, "Oh my gosh, guys, my babysitter voted for Joe Biden." That is the mindset of the secessionists. Like, because they had a different opinion, I can't be involved with them. I can't be around them. I can't let them around my kids. We've got to get past that.
Mm-hmm.
Because a civil war, if one were ever to break out in this country, there would be stacks of corpses. You might be among them. Your children might be among them. Certainly, people you know would be among them. These idiots who march in our cities and who tweet about how they're ready to throw down to save the Republic, they're ready to fight fascism, they will be among the first to see their lives forever changed if we ever saw a real civil war. The Civil War killed 600,000 people, but it changed millions of lives, most of them, excepting the slaves, for the worse. Freed slaves, of course it changed their lives for the better. And I'm not saying that the Civil War wasn't necessary. But a Civil War now, okay, it might make things better for some people, but it will touch the lives of every single American. So my last words on the Civil War would be simply this: be careful what you wish for.
Thank you for joining us in our discussion of the Civil War Part 2. I'm Joe Parker.
And I'm John Streeter.
Be sure to leave us a review wherever you listen to this podcast. It really does help. Thank you, and see you all next week.